As a child, Otha Ellis Bates McDaniel taught himself to play guitar, but he never found one he liked, so he built his own. Soon after, his rectangular-shaped axe with an old TV dial for a volume knob could be heard on radios everywhere as he launched the beat heard round the world. He was Bo Diddley. His handmade guitar is at the Hard Rock Cafe, Times Square. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history are at Hard Rock Cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com. Don't let it slide, baby, diamond ring.
And now, Little Stephen's Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
It's time for your Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock and Little Stephen's Underground Garage. I'm the Mighty Manfred. Thanks for listening, and please remember to follow and subscribe, rate, and review. Today I'm speaking with Dom Mariani, who is based in Perth, Australia, and is the creative force behind several bands we feature here in the Underground Garage, including The Stems, DM3, The Majestic Kelp, and Datura 4. And today we'll be focusing on the latter. This summer, the Datura 4 will release a new album called Neanderthal Jam, which is home to our recent coolest song in the world, Open the Line. We'll hear a portion of that now, followed by my interview with Dom on your Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock in Little Stephen's Underground Garage. Open the line. With the Mighty Manfred and Little Stephen's Underground Garage, and it's time for today's Coolest Conversations. My guest is Dom Mariani, the Australian singer, songwriter, guitarist, and producer. He's based in Perth, and we feature a number of his bands here in the Underground Garage, including The Stems, DM3, and Majestic Kelp. Today, though, we are focusing on the Datura 4. They'll have a new album coming out this summer called Neanderthal Jam, and right now it's supplied us with this week's coolest song of the world, Open the Line. Hey, Dom, how are you?
I'm doing well, Manfred. Good to talk to you again.
Yes, absolutely. You know, we spoke last, it was May of 2020, and I'm assuming things are much better in Perth now, are they?
Well, it's funny you should sort of ask that question, because I guess Perth was one of the last of the our state, West Australia, was one of the last states to sort of open up, you might say, from lockdowns and with the COVID thing. So we're actually going through a bit of a COVID spike here at the moment. So while we were locked down, we didn't have much of it sort of coming in. There's, you know, a few cases came through, but now I think we're sort of over the peak. We're sort of on the way down with the numbers. But yeah, we're probably one of the last of the. But we are the last of the states to really sort of have the surge, you might say. So yeah, look, we're all okay here. It hasn't come into my household yet. I know a few people that have had it, but we're sort of out there. We're not locked down anymore, but we're just sort of getting on with things and accepting it, I guess, in a way.
Right. So you're able to play gigs and restaurants and so forth. None of that is.
Yeah, look, we've been lucky. We've had gigs going, but it has been difficult to tour outside of the state. And with the restrictions and what have you, they've limited numbers at venues. So capacities have been dropped. And like the Hoodoo Gurus, for example, had a festival or had a big gig here with the Dandy Warhols, and they were due to play this weekend or the last weekend, and they had to cancel because they sold a lot of tickets, but the government decided that the cap on open air festivals was going to be 500 people, so that didn't quite work for them. So they decided to reschedule until things were opened up a little bit more.
And I also read about them. I thought that the their drummer had contracted COVID, and they had to cancel shows as well.
That's right. Just to top things off, that's the recent bit of news. Yeah, so they've had to reschedule again for later on in the year, which they've had a bit of a run of bad luck.
I spoke with Brad Shepherd from the Hoodoo Gurus just a couple of weeks ago. Do you guys have much of a relationship with them, or you with Dave Faulkner? Because I know he's from Perth originally.
Yeah, we know those guys quite well, and I've played many gigs. They tour four have played with them. We did a show here on Rottnest Island. But my bands over the years have always had a good relationship. The Stems obviously have played with the Gurus many times, and DM3 played with them a bunch of times. So yeah, it's been a good association. They've always been good to us or to my bands anyway.
Do you know you have a Wikipedia page?
I think I do know that. Yeah.
Well, it tells me that you were born in 1958. Is that true?
That's correct. That's true. Yes.
So you were 10 by 68. The Easy Beats were still having hits then. And I was wondering, was there any epiphany as a kid that you had where you saw or you heard something and you decided, I must rock, I must make music?
I think I had that pretty early on, you know. Obviously the Beatles were, you know, in my consciousness at the time. I do recall hearing them a fair bit. And my parents were into music, so Elvis was played a fair bit at home. But there were some TV shows here that featured music, and that's where I got to see and hear a lot of it. And obviously the Top 40 radio played a big part. So, there were songs that, you know, I heard when I was young that, still mean quite a bit to me now. And, I just kept following it. You know, I just knew I loved music, I suppose. And I begged my dad to buy me a guitar. I started guitar lessons. I think I would have been 8 or 9. It took a while for me to really apply myself because I got the guitar, but then I didn't realize that, you know, you had to actually practice to play it. I would just strum it, you know, and sort of sing these songs, you know, make a racket basically to start with. But then, you know, I learned a couple of things, and, you know, the penny dropped when I was probably about 12, 13. I could play a 12-bar blues and, started learning a few songs that I liked. And just kept going, basically. I really, really loved it. And I think it's all I wanted to do. You know, I had my mindset on playing music.
And so your parents, they got you this guitar early on. You said there was always music in the house. How did they feel about you trying to pursue music?
Well, they liked the idea of me playing music, and my parents my father especially would say, well, you know, it's a good thing to do, but I don't think you should be making a profession out of it. You should go and do some study, and you can play a few shows on the weekend and, you know, get off that way. But I think I took it a little bit more seriously. My dad was very proud of the fact that I actually got into it and, learned to play the guitar reasonably well. He would always, you know, brag to his friends that, you know, I could play the guitar, and he'd always find me for wherever I was, you know, outside, and he'd drag me in and try and get me to play in front of them, you know, which was a bit of a drag, actually. I didn't enjoy that too much.
So it's kind of hard to rebel against that if your dad is pushing a no, go ahead, son. Well, make some of that modern racket for these guys.
Well, it was quite funny because he would tell his friends, my dad was, he's Italian descent, obviously, and he had his Italian friends come over, and he'd sort of tell them all about me, and then he'd start to say things like, oh, well, he's into heavy music, he's into heavy music. He's not into the music that you would probably like or know, but he's into this heavy stuff, It's quite funny.
You made a comment about, I guess, in your formative years there around 8 or 9 and you're picking up on the Beatles, and there was also television shows you would see. And I'm wondering if was one of those Saturday Date, seems like that was an Australian TV show. I'm not sure, we lost those sort of Top of the Pops kind of shows, if they were shown nationally across Australia, where they were just specific to certain, like in Melbourne would have a show like that, and Brisbane would have a show like that.
There were a few national shows. One was Bandstand, which I can't recall. That would have been like on a Saturday night, I think it might have been. But there was another one. There's a guy here by the name of Johnny Young who wrote some sort of fairly big singles for some artists back in the 60s. Russell Morris, I don't know if you've heard of Russell Morris. He wrote a song called The Real Thing, this guy Johnny Young, and he had a television show here. I can't remember what it was called. I think it was maybe Teen Scene or something like that, or Teen Beat. But the TV shows that really got me in were, it was a TV show called Uptight to start with, and it changed its name to Happening 70 once it went from the 60s to the 70s. And, and that was on Saturday afternoon, and it would go on for about 3 hours. And they would play all sorts of stuff, and they'd have, obviously Australian groups on there, but also, clips of the Beatles and, the Shocking Blue and, My Bella Me by the T-Set. I remember that. And, that's Australian bands like The Strangers and The Masters Apprentices, Easy Beats, The Axiom and Twilights and all these really great bands. So, I was, we didn't really do that much on a Saturday afternoon except watch that TV show for 3 hours. And, I loved it. And then, as I got older, there was a TV show here called GTK, which I think stands for Get to Know, which was about 5 or 10 minutes long. And there was one about 6:30 every night during the week. And they would feature a band playing live or something that was sort of related to the art scene, but mostly music. And, you see bands like Led Zeppelin and some Australian bands like Billy Thorpe and the Aztecs and people like that. So, I was a total tragic for the music, that's for sure.
I was going to ask about Billy Thorpe in a moment, but last time we were talking about the Detour 4, and you mentioned growing up, listening to blues rock stuff, but you didn't name any specific artists. So what are some of these blues rock artists that, sort of played around and got inside your head and we might hear coming out, influenced you and with the Detour 4?
Yeah, I guess very early on it would have been, Creedence Clearwater Revival, really. That kind of, I guess they were blues-based, they had the swamp sound and all that kind of thing, and that kind of evolved to the Stones, I guess. One of the first albums I had was Get Your Ya-Ya's Out and then Let It Bleed. And that kind of led to like bands like Cream, Jimi Hendrix. And from there, it kind of, I started discovering all these sort of blues people and there were guitar players from the US like Johnny Winter. And then you had the English bands like, 10 Years After. And, discovered bands like that, I guess, which were very blues-based. The Yardbirds and Led Zeppelin, all that kind of thing. It's just a big melting pot of blues-based music. I guess the British blues boom, with John Mayle and the Blues Breakers, all those, Eric Clapton. Yeah, there's so many of them, and I I got right into it. You know, I really enjoyed that music.
Right. As your dad said, you were into the heavy music.
Yeah. Look, you know, at my generation, I guess when I was, 15, 16, there were bands like your Black Sabbath and your Led Zeppelin were popular. And you know, we were all picking up on new bands. You know, we were, I guess, very impressionable and naive, I guess, in a way. We weren't sort of too affected by, you know, what was cool and what wasn't cool. But that they were the cool bands at the time. You know, the guys in my class that would sort of go, hey, have you heard this this album, Masters of Reality by Black Sabbath? And I looked at the cover and I went, wow, man, that's incredible. That the black and purple cover, I've never seen anything like that. That looks heavy. You know, they haven't heard it yet, but it just... there's something sort of, you know, quite sinister in that packaging. So I was just, you know, listening to a lot of stuff, really. But you know, always a big fan of the, you know, the pop thing as well. You know, like I was always a big fan of songs. So right. You know, the Beatles would always be my favorite band, but you know, I love people like the Bee Gees as well, you know, and people like that. So I guess I absorbed a lot of different things.
Oh, absolutely. That's pretty clear through all the different groups that you've headed and sort of the sort of genres those sort of groups kind of work in. The reason I wanted to ask you about Billy Thorpe was because I guess I was 12 or 13 and was living in Atlanta, Georgia. And he had an album that came out, Children of the Sun, and it came out on Capricorn Records, which was based in Georgia out of Augusta. I can't think, Paul or Peter, I can't think. The guy that ran Capricorn Records was Otis Redding's manager back in the 60s, and his name is escaping me right now. But that came out on that label, and around that time, the label went bust. And so the record appeared, and then it disappeared, and that song, Children of the Sun, was getting played on all the big rock stations, and it was to a 13-year-old, you know, just like it was like mind blowing. Like, who the hell is this guy? You know, there was no. Yeah. I did not even know he was Australian until a couple of years ago. Right? It was like I was thinking, God, whatever happened to that guy? So how did you view like somebody like Billy Thorpe as opposed to? Did he not seem as exotic to you since he was from Australia, whereas? You know, getting into Black Sabbath and Led Zeppelin, that seemed like really cool. And or did these Australian groups, I mean, did they hold the same sort of presence over your, those have the same sort of presence in your mind?
Yeah, look, absolutely. I wasn't sort of discriminating at all. Billy Thorpe, I recall him, you know, as a sort of a 60s pop idol. You know, he had short blonde hair and he had a big hit here with Over the Rainbow. I remember that one. He did a version of that. And he also had a version of Poison Ivy. And then he disappeared for a while and reappeared in the sort of early 70s as this kind of long-haired, you know, grown a beard. And, you know, he got into the heavy stuff and he had a big hit with a song called Most People I Know Think I'm Crazy. So he had the reputation of being the Billy Thorpe and the New Aztecs as one of the loudest bands, you know, on the circuit. And, you know, they did a lot of kind of souped up sort of 50s rock, you know, in a 70s kind of boogie style. I love that. And that's I was telling you about that show GTK, and they featured a lot of those bands. The GTK was big during that era, that TV show, and there were bands like Carson, Band of Light, Buffalo, you know, later day Master's Apprentices, because Master's Apprentices had an album, Toast of Panama Red, or Toast to Panama Red, or I think it was called. So that, you know, it was their sort of style became heavier as well. So it was very much that kind of progressive blues rock that they were getting into. And there was a pretty good scene here in Australia for that. And where I live here in Perth, there was a couple of notable bands. One was called Bakery and another one was called Fatty Lumpkin. Now, Fatty Lumpkin had a hit single here. It was called Don't Knock Your Boogie. And Bob Patient, who plays keyboards on the in our band, he was in a lineup of Fatty Lumpkin. He was in that band after that single. So he's been around a long, long time. And he's definitely added a lot to our group and enabled me to kind of fulfill my crazy ideas, I guess, you know, expanding the songs that I'm writing.
Well, let's talk about some of these crazy ideas, because this week's coolest song in the world is Open the Line off the upcoming album Neanderthal Jam that's due out this summer. When and where did you record the album?
Well, it started in a place here. Well, the guys relocated, but the album previous, West Coast Highway Cosmic, was kind of, I guess, inspired by his studio, because his studio is on West Coast Highway here, which is a highway that's runs along the coast here, sort of from the suburb here, I guess you'd say Cottesloe up to Sorrento. Anyway, that studio's called Kenny Watts Kilowatt Studio. So we started the album there. We did most of the recording there, and then we took it down to Reel to Reel, which is south of Perth here, and we did a little bit more recording and mixed it with a guy named James Newhouse.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about him, because I saw him listed in my notes as being the engineer, but he did not work on West Coast Highway Cosmic.
He did, yes, he did. More or less the same. Yeah, we've used the same combination for most of the albums, except for the first one. The first one was recorded somewhere else to start with, and then James actually mixed it. But the second album, Hairy Mountain, and the third one, Blessed is the Boogie, were more or less done the same way. We sort of track with Kenny at Kilowatt Studios, and then we do a bit of extra recording with James and mix it, do the final mix with him. Yeah.
So you guys recorded all the same time, you're all in the same room, or was this, there weren't any pandemic restrictions going on?
No, most of it was, we tracked in the same room. It would have been myself and Warren to start with in some of the songs. There was three or four songs we actually did all together. That was with James actually in his studio down south. So yeah, it's we usually try and track or do the beds live, and then add whatever we need to do later on top. You know, if we can get a good live take, you know, we usually keep that and work on it.
So what is the difference between the two studios? Why, I mean, what is it about Kilowatts going there first and then? Because you're doing some tracking at James's place as well. Is there, like, does the Kilowatts have like a high ceilings, or is there more or better room sound there? Go ahead.
Well, I guess Kenny's studio would be more the location. It's close because James now, his studio is a couple of hours out of Perth, so we have to go specifically down there and stay there a few days to actually do that. But Kenny has a great setup. He's got, you know, some great old gear, and he's got a small room. So we basically have the drums set up in a room, and then we have a guitar, amps in another room, and we kind of, I guess, we make eye contact through, you know, the windows in the studio. Whereas James's studio is one room which has got a high ceiling. It's like an old I think it was an old garage to start with, and he kitted it out into a studio. So that one there is definitely more, the whole band can basically set up and put a few baffles between the instruments and stuff. But Kenny's is smaller, so it's more of a situation where the drums are isolated, and then we have an isolation booth for the amps. And we try and do it that way.
So when you're at James's place, you can claim that it's a garage blues rock, since it was technically
a
garage.
Yeah, exactly. It's garage rock.
Garage rock. So did you write Open the Line? Is that like a more recent song, or was it something that was percolating for a while? Well, when did you write that?
That's a pretty fairly recent, you know, like obviously when I say recent, you know, it's in the last, 18 months or so. It came, I guess a lot of the songs that I write are pretty much observational about, you know, what's going on around me and the state of the world and stuff. But, you know, I sort of disguise it in different sort of ways of sort of telling the story. I'm worried about the way the state of the world and just things like that, just what I think everybody worries about these days. So, I try and sort of bring that out in my songs in some way. Open the Line is very much about it. It's not, I guess you wouldn't say it's a wordy song, but the message is definitely, about communicating, you know, getting someone to sort of listen to you or, which I guess seems quite apt with what's going on right now.
Absolutely. In fact, I like the phrase "open the line," right? Lines of communication. Makes me wonder, line as it relates to like phones. You know, it was like a thing at one point, and now I guess the association between a line and a phone isn't necessary, but. Do you have a landline at your home? Is it, do people in Perth have landlines still? Or
I think we've got one here still. I don't answer it very, very often. It does ring, but I always find it some, bogus call. Some scam, some guy at the other end of the line from the Philippines or something like that. But
Do you have guys from the Philippines calling to offer to buy your house?
They're trying to sell me stuff. I don't know. Or they're trying to alert me to something that's gone wrong.
Is great. And how considerate of them, all the way around the world. And they're worried about, that there might be some scam on your computer and you only have to send them a few. If you could just give them your bank account number, everything would be fine.
Exactly.
So the album opens up with this really cool sort of driving song going back to Hoonsville. I could not find that on a map. Is that a real place or a mythical destination? Or
well, it's a term here we use that call hoons. And a hoon is someone who is really infatuated by cars, I guess, and sort of doing burnouts and things like that. We have this, it's an Australian thing, and we call it, like these guys, we call them bogans or rev heads here. And they congregate in certain parts of the city where, they do their burnouts with their cars, and they get together and drink and try and sort of show each other's cars off. And there's been a few laws that have been implemented in recent times to try and stop these guys from doing this. So they call them hoons, and they says hooning is no longer allowed. So yeah, Hoonsville it very much relates to our culture here. It's a very big part of where I grew up here in Fremantle, where there was a lot of hoons, you might say, people who are into hotted up cars and they're like sort of racing around in the streets and with their loud sort of cars. And Hoonsville, it's a fictitious place. And
it's on the first of album mind. Is that it? Hoonsville's a state of mind.
It is a state of mind. And we had a song on the first album called Hoonsville, which it sort of kicked it off, really. It's sort of an instrumental with this sort of we added a little bit of racetrack sort of ambience behind the song. And this song came up, or this riff came up, and I thought, wow, this it's got kind of a heavy kind of rockabilly kind of vibe to it or something. It the garage rock thing came back. And I thought, well, this going back to Hoonsville, it's got that vibe, something about hooning in this song. So I thought, I'm going back to Hoonsville, and started writing these words, you know. And it all came flowing through, all this, you know, all this stuff that I knew as a, you know, a rev head, being a rev head myself.
Well, I'm wondering, so over here, you know, there's a hot rod culture and guys tricking out the cars. And but then there's this kind of this separate thing, and maybe this is more like these hoons, where these cars are you know, like little Hondas or Datsuns, but they're like all tricked out, and it's almost farcical, you know, and they're as opposed to like some sort of classic like hot rod thing. And I don't honestly, I have no idea whether those two circles overlap here. I would have to think that the more like the classic hot rod guys would kind of, you know, would be a bit disdainful at these guys souping up these little Toyotas and Hondas. Well, what kind of cars are the hoons all into? I mean, is it like really showy? Are these cool old cars, or are these like like contemporary Yugos that they're like souping up, or what?
Yeah, more contemporary cars, you know, like, but it goes back, you know, to a few decades. So, you know, we have the General Motors equivalent here, which was the Holden. And we had these cars, the Monaro, which was, you know, sort of like a muscle car, I guess. And then the Ford equivalent, which was the Falcon, which was like the G, you know, was it the 351, you know, Ford Shaker we had here. And you know, I guess that's the equivalent to what I guess you have over there, like the Dodge and the Camaros and that kind of thing. So yeah, and it's these young guys that buy these, you know, I guess powerful cars, and they like to hot them up and show them off, and you know, race them around the neighborhood.
The neighborhood
being chased by the cops, you know, the cops don't like them. No.
Well, it gives the cops something to do, though.
It does, yeah. So, hooning is definitely a pastime here in Australia. I guess when we're releasing that as the second single, and I have a little blurb on that. That sort of explains the whole thing. There's actually a some kind of definition in a dictionary or somewhere, hooning.
So thinking about, cars and racing, and that made me think about road trips. And, you know, in the U.S., there's Route 66, and people, I think of people really going from the east to the west coast, but going along this route. And, of course, now they can just use the interstates. But there are people that still take the old route just to see, you know, the what's left of the roadside attractions. Is the notion of taking a road trip, is that anything that exists in Australian culture, like going from Melbourne out to Perth? Is that a thing people do?
Yeah, look, it still goes on. We have what they call the Nullarbor plane here, which, you know, there is a route from Perth to Sydney and back again. So I did that a couple of times back in the sort of 80s when we couldn't afford to fly. We would drive across, you know, to tour, you know, so that was a big thing back then. And obviously, you know, going here in the West, we're sort of going from Perth down south or up north. So there's definitely a lot of road here, and we have a lot of wilderness as well. So, you know, people do like to get out there. And
are there any kind of like roadside attractions, anything that you can think of that sort of an oddball sort of like heading out west? There's the corn for us. There's like the Corn Palace, and you know, there are Cadillacs buried in the desert, you know, sticking around. Is there anything like that?
Not so much here in the west. On the east coast, there is. I don't know if you've heard of it, but they have these. I guess you'd call them roadhouses, and you know, that they're sort of unique in that one would be called the big pineapple, maybe a bit monstrous pineapple, you know, and the prawn, which would be, you know, like a shrimp, I guess, and a monstrous shrimp on top of this, you know, roadhouse. And I think there's the banana, and there's all those things all the way up on the East Coast that they are attractions, I guess, for people that sort of driving up and down that coast.
Well, I've always heard the prawns were quite big there in Australia, you know, so they just strapped one at the top of the building.
Strapped one at the top of the roadhouse, yeah. They caught a big one.
So another track on the album, Black Speakers, sing about the virtues of what I imagine to be an awesome speaker stack. What do you have for speakers at home? Because, you know, inquiring audiophiles want to know.
Yeah, my speakers are black. They are. but I can't remember what the name is. I guess that one there. Yeah, it's one of those plays on the idea of, you know, music, you know, taking you to another place, you know.
Makes me think of that. What was it? Did you guys ever see this? There was an ad, a print ad, that they would use here. I think it was for like cassette tapes, Memorex cassette tapes, and the picture is this guy sitting in like a chair, and his hair is being blown back, and maybe the lamp is being pushed over, but he's, you know, facing a set of speakers. They're supposed to be blowing him away with all this the power of the speaker.
I've never seen that. But that tune, you know, started sort of a Hendrixy kind of vibe to it. The imagery is kind of surreal, I guess, in a way. I had fun with that one. I really enjoyed that one, and that was one of those tunes that sort of came out of a jam session, really. We just kind of had this riff, and then we just started sort of playing it, and it sort of went in that direction, you know. So we thought, oh, this is sounding pretty good, so let's put it down.
Well, speaking of the jam, the title track is Neanderthal Jam. That's an instrumental. Is it an instrumental because Neanderthals didn't speak? Did they just communicate with rock? I mean, I know they're primitive, totally primitive.
Yeah, look, I've always loved that word, Neanderthal. And, you know, I guess what we do in a way, you know, we try and keep it fairly basic and add a lot of flavours to it, obviously. And, you know, just jamming on, you know, riffs that are, you know, not too kind of complicated, but, you know, have a kind of feel and vibe about them, you know, and I guess in certain parts it sort of felt like we were sort of doing something that's kind of Neanderthal in a way. So it's sort of simple and sort of rock and basic, you know. So I just thought the word came up and we thought that sounds pretty cool. Someone says, oh, we've got to call it something jam. And I said, how about Neanderthal Jam? And everyone seemed to like it. It seemed to stick, you know.
Yeah. Well, have you ever done any of these genetic tests? Because you can determine how much Neanderthal DNA you have, you know.
Really? I didn't know about that.
Yeah. My daughter, it was a weird, she several years ago, she'll be 20 in May. And when around the time she was 14, she wanted to do, as a birthday present, she wanted to do a genetic test. And her mom and I were like, well, okay, sure, you know. And sometimes, you know, these tests come back and there's all this bizarre sort of family history that gets turned around, you know. That wasn't the case. It was like, so it's like, yeah, honey, that's kind of what we knew. But she had some, you know, like we have some Neanderthal in there, so, you know, a little bit. And so then I had this. So then me later, it turns out, a quick digression, my mom passed away a couple of years ago. And then the big reveal after her passing, and I thought the big reveal was going to be the fact that my dad said to me, I don't know where your mama's gun has gone to. I can't find it anywhere. And I was like, well, she had a gun, you know, because she was very much like, you know, a pro gun control kind of person. But, you know, she had apparently this 38 special she had had in the house, you know. anyway, it turns out that what had happened, though, was I have a full brother, and that was never grew up with us. And my mom was from Germany, my dad from America. She came over to study, and they started dating and got pregnant. And my dad did not know this, and my mom went back to Germany. But before that, the university sent her off to a place where unwed mothers go to have the child, and then it was put up for adoption. And then after college, my dad went at the service, and he was stationed in France, and my mom and he reconnected. And so later on in life, my mother did reach out and to my brother, Kevin, and they were started communicating. And I've since met him, and he's a great, great guy. And he, you know, has had a full life. He's a professor at a university in South Georgia. And in any event, the reason going into that, he was very intent on, you know, he wanted us, my dad, my brother, my youngest brother, to all take these genetic tests, because I'm sure he just wanted to confirm things. And that was fine. We did that. And I was just only disappointed that I did not have as much Neanderthal as I had hoped. You know, it's like my daughter somehow had more Neanderthal than me. But
then you.
Yeah, it was like I was.
You got
the
Neanderthal gene.
Well, you know, you're like you as a part of your musical sort of frame of reference there is, you know, a garage kind of garage rocker. And kind of like the idea, back to the track too, Neanderthal gene, kind of like this sort of, you know, primitive, kind of like the idea of having that in my genetic code. You know, of course I'm a garage rocker. I can't help it. It's in my genes. So.
I like that. I think that's right.
Well, I saw that when we spoke before, you had talked about saying how you're always writing. And I was wondering, how does that work? Like right now, we're talking about Day 204. If you were kind of in the midst of this as the main focus, are you like you're devoting your energies to writing Day 204 songs, or does something come in your head and you just kind of follow that out and then go, you know, this might work for the stems, this might work for DM3. I'll just kind of keep that for that project the next time I'm working on it. Or are you more focused on one group at a time and writing in that vein?
Well, yeah, Day 204 is pretty much in the forefront of what I'm doing, really, as far as writing. But yeah, look, I'm still writing, you know, other tunes, which, you know, I guess wouldn't work for Day 204 because of, you know, they're either, you know, they're too poppy or they're just different, you know, more of a sort of folk rock kind of thing. So in actual fact, I'm working on a solo record. I've started recording that. I'm about halfway through, and I do some more tracks in a couple of weeks' time. So yeah, look, I'm still working on that stuff as well. So yeah, it's, you know, songs come. I'm not that focused on it at the moment, but there will be a time where I want to finish that record. And yeah, so but at the moment I'm just sort of putting the beds down. I've got 11 songs that I've written that over the last, I guess, 10, 12 years that I've accumulated that I think, well, those songs will work for something, but I'm not sure what that is. And now it's become a solo record. So yeah.
So the solo album, I'm intrigued by this because, you know, the other groups, you know, the stems, not exclusively garage rocky, but that if you have to pigeonhole it, you know, then that's more of that. The DM3 more of a power popish thing. Day 204 more of a blues rock thing. Does this, the solo recording is just all over the map then?
Yeah, pretty much. Probably closer to say something like the DM3 stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, in that kind of, I guess, melodic guitar rock kind of style. But it is a little bit more eclectic. You know, there are tunes there. You know, there's a couple of tunes that are sort of more like sort of folk rock. You know, once it's finished, I'll know what to make of it. But at the moment, I've got these tunes, you know, I'm sort of jamming with a few guys that are helping me put it together. And it's usually a case of, you know, the way that they turn out is really a reflection of the way the different musicians bring their own personalities to the song. So I have a sort of a vision of how I want that song to sound. I kind of try and, you know, push that those ideas forward. But then at the end of the day, when the band starts playing them and jamming on them, they will evolve into something that, you know, might be quite different. I don't know. You know, it's that's how I generally approach things. The song in my head is always fully formed.
Right.
But then when I go to record it, it's not often that it actually comes out the way it sort of sounded in my head, you know. But
is that good or bad?
Mostly good, yeah. You know. I sort of sit back and go, wow, yeah, that's gone somewhere else, but I really like where it's gone, or that's come pretty close to what I was thinking. So, you know, occasionally you get things that don't work, so you shelve them or you revisit them at another time. But, it's really the sum of the people that, you know, are in the studio sort of working on it. That's the way I like to do it.
When you mention folk rock, I mean, that to me, that conjures up ringing out 12 string with these kind of jangly ringing out chords, which is a sound I love. When you say folk rock, what are you thinking? Folk rock, what are you thinking?
Yeah, the Birds.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. Love and Spoonful. That style of music. The Birds probably would be the main reference for the few tunes that I've got that sound like that. Yeah.
Very cool. Well, I was looking through your Facebook page and I saw something about the Detour of Four playing a kind of a music show. In fact, we talked earlier about the shows you used to see, when you were a kid growing up, the 60s shows. And what is this thing called The Scene? Is that like a contemporary version of those earlier programs, or it's just live acts? What is The Scene? And can we watch that?
Yeah, you can. It's actually went live this evening. So it was on Foxtel here earlier this evening, and I think it's on YouTube now. It's a small team of people that have put this show together, and it's based here in Perth. And what they do is, I think they have, I think they're into their eighth series, I think it is, and they get two bands every Monday night, and they record the bands doing a couple of tunes each, and then they do a little interview. So it's pretty much a little profile for the bands, and it's Perth bands, West Australian bands, and we were lucky enough to get asked to do it. And it sounded pretty good, I must say. I was pretty happy with the way it turned out.
So it's on YouTube. So how would we how do we find that? We just do a search on YouTube for Detour of Four, The Scene, and it should pop up.
Yeah, I think so. That would be it. I haven't watched it on YouTube, I must say, yet, but I will try to do that. I saw it on Foxtel.
So the show's called The Scene, and you're saying it kind of focuses on local bands there in the Perth area?
Yeah. So there's all sorts of styles, really. So it's I guess we were probably one of the more heavier acts they had there. It's nice to be asked to be a part of that. It's a fairly commercial kind of thing. They have a little audience that they have, and they set it all up and then get you to run through a few tunes, and then you do a little interview. So it's pretty cool. It's actually I didn't know about it until maybe 6 months ago. It had been going for quite a while and I hadn't heard about it.
So it's interesting to me it's called The Scene, because I want to ask you about this. Perth is pretty isolated, right? I mean, it's pretty far from the rest. It's all the way on the West Coast. I looked at a driving map, it's like 37 hours driving from like Melbourne to Perth. That's, you know, so it's pretty far out there. You were mentioning, we were talking about the pandemic. I mean, things were, you know, it was kind of shut off there, but it seems like locally there's a lot of stuff that, that does go on. I know that these guys, like, we've talked about the Huda Gurus, but that Dave Faulkner and the Kim Salmon from Perth, and they left as soon as they were having music stuff going on. You stayed. And there are other groups that we, from Perth, that we play in the underground garage, like the Chevelles. And it just seems like there is, it's kind of, it's, it does have aspects to its own world, its own sort of scene out there. Is that right? Or what is it like? Is it sort of, yeah, what is it like, the scene?
Yeah, it's always been fairly healthy, like the scene here. Like, we've had a couple of major bands come out of this city, which, you know, it's quite unusual in a way, being so isolated. One in case would be the Tame Impala, who are massive, you know, and those guys, you know, they live not far from my place here. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they've become a massive band. And the, another band a few years ago, Sleepy Jackson, I don't know if you've heard of those guys, they were quite big. Luke Steele, I think he lives in the States these days. But yeah, it's a pretty healthy scene. I think back in the days when, you know, Dave Faulkner and Kim Salmon were around, you know, there wasn't a lot of opportunities for bands of that ilk here. So they had to go to Melbourne or Sydney to be, you know, to have some success or to sort of make it, I guess, in the scene, because we're, you know, it's so isolated here. But now, I guess, you know, it's a lot easier just through, you know, the radio networks and, you know, mm-hmm. the internet and everything. Bands can actually base themselves here and thrive in Perth. I think the Stems were one of the early ones to sort of do it from Perth, in that we decided that, you know, we'd release something. We were lucky we got picked up by a label on the East Coast. It took a, you know, chance on us, and that did really well. So when we eventually went there, and we did a small stint there in Sydney, for we would stay there for 3 months while things were bubbling, and it really took off for us. So we then decided to come back to Perth, and we thought, well, we'll see if we can do it from Perth. And it worked for us, because every time we would do the East Coast sort of run, we were more or less like a touring band.
Right.
So we weren't a local band as such, whereas, you know, if you moved to Sydney or Melbourne, you were kind of engulfed into the scene. And there were some bands from here that did go over during those days that, you know, that broke up. They couldn't sort of, you know, they couldn't make any headway. Dave and Kim were probably the exception. They sort of hung in there long enough, and finally they kind of broke through. But mostly a lot of bands just went over, and you never heard from them again.
So the Stems kept their kind of exoticness.
And, yeah, you know, we were quite lucky. You know, that's purely by accident and by luck, really. You know, it sort of worked for us.
Now we're going to take a listen to one more track off of Neanderthal Jam in a moment. It's Digging My Own Grave. And in those lyrics, you sing about a pain in every teardrop. Man, it sounds like a lot of hurt going on, and also pretty scary. You know, you're digging your own grave. From what sort of wellspring did that one issue forth?
Well, it's just kind of personal, that one. It goes back to experience, I guess, in my own life, you know, having had sort of issues with, you know, sort of a depression, I suppose, that I had, you know, a fair few years ago. Unless you've really had depression, you know what it's like. It's, you know, people that haven't had it, you know, it's very hard to explain to them what it is. Yeah, I guess, you know, that it's always there for me. But, you know, I've managed to sort of rise above it and I guess keep it at bay in a way. But, yeah, so there are songs that I've written that sort of allude to that. the black dog, you might, as they say. So yeah, it's kind of a personal take on it. And once again, you know, sort of use it as a vehicle to kind of bring some imagery into it. And yeah, that's digging my own grave.
So do you, you said that, did I hear you correctly? Something about 20 years ago or 30 years, did you have like a particular episode that was hard to get through, and then you've been dealing with that going forward?
Yeah, it was after the stems. I had a breakdown, and I was not in a good place for quite a few years. Mm-hmm. At the time, you know, it wasn't one of those things that was really talked about, and yeah. We eventually came to grips with what it was. Because, you know, it was one of those things, you know, like you have a breakdown and it's very hard to sort of open up to people and say, hey, you know, I'm losing it here. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it took a few years to sort of come, you know, I guess get used to the idea of what had happened to me. And then, you know, the word depression came in and it was like, wow, yeah, you know.
What prompted you to write the song? Is this a recent one or older tune that you decided to record
It's a recent one, but you know, like it's always there,
right?
And it's something that it's something that I can relate to. You know, it's so prevalent, you know, in our society. You know, friends of mine and. You know, occasionally, you know, I get the blues you go into those dark places, but I'm able to kind of keep that at bay and with things that I've learned to do over the years, you know, with meditation or, you know, just getting away. And the music's always been a really good therapy for me. I remember at the time when that happened to me, one of the best things I did was rather than just sort of, you know, completely, you know, go into, you know, hibernation or, you know, shut myself off from the scene, I kind of kept going. I played in a friend's band called the Summer Suns, and then I had a project called The Some Loves that was sort of between DM3 and The Stems, which was a one-off album that I did. That kept me sort of going in a way.
Yeah.
And even though I had all these demons that I was sort of fighting in my head, it gave me something to do. And well, eventually,
right. At the same time, I'm sorry. Please continue.
Yeah, and eventually over time, it sort of. I overcame it, you know, with the help of medication, obviously, at the time. But eventually, you know, managed to get off that as well.
I was just going to add in there. I mean, so you got music, you know, helping you as well through that period of time. But you were also married and you were also working. And I'm not sure, you know, when your children were born, but it seems like that would. All that going on at the same time would be pretty hard.
Yeah, look, the family thing was definitely a big help as well. You know, I have to sort of help, have to say that my wife definitely helped me through things. And at the time, we had a young child, and that definitely played on my mind. Or, you know, sort of thinking, well, I've got to support this young child. So, to go out and get myself a job. just things like that, you know, sort of those responsibilities come into play. I had a good family behind me that sort of helped me through it as well. You know, having that sort of support meant a lot.
Dom, I want to thank you so much for joining me today for our Coolest Conversations.
It's always a pleasure.
Let's give a listen now to Digging My Own Grave. It's Datura 4 off their upcoming album, Neanderthal Jam, in Little Steven's Underground Garage. Digging My Own Grave. That's day 204 here in Little Stephen's Underground Garage from their upcoming album, Neanderthal Jam, due out this summer. Thanks again to Don Mariani for joining me today to talk about the upcoming release, and also to Sammy Semenza for producing our podcast. Please join me next time around while I will check in with singer-songwriter Ryan Hamilton. His 1221 album was recently made available on vinyl as part of a special Record Store Day release. We'll find out what else he's been up to on your Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock in Little Stephen's Underground Garage.
In the mid-50s, two men knocked over a kerosene stove during a fight at a concert. After fleeing the blaze, the guitar player realized he left his beloved Gibson inside. B.B. King then ran in and saved it. He later learned that the fight was over a woman named Lucille, and ever since, his guitars have borne that name. You can find Lucille at the Hard Rock in Hollywood, Florida. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.